You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I am a scientist. I am a scientist. I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone.
Welcome to Unbiased Science, where we bring scientific method to the madness. We're your hosts, Dr. Jessica Steyer.
And Dr. Andrea Love.
And oh my gosh, this week we have a very special guest who you all have been requesting for, I don't even know, for years at this point, Dr. Jen Gunter, who honestly needs no introduction, but I will share her very impressive bio with you. But Jen, thank you so much for joining us today to talk menopause.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So Dr. Jen Gunter is an OBGYN and pain medicine physician and health communicator. She is a renowned expert in vaginal and vulvar health and menopause. She is the author of 2 New York Times best-selling books, The Menopause Manifesto and The Vagina Bible, translated into 20 languages and counting, and writes a lot about sex, science, and social media. She has often been referred to as Twitter's resident gynecologist and the internet's OBGYN. She is devoted and vocal about calling out junk science and snake oil across the internet, especially about women's health topics. Her newest book, Blood, The Science, Medicine, and Mythology of Menstruation, was released yesterday, January 23rd, and we cannot wait to read it. Again, Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you can find Jen, and of course, we'll link to this in our show notes, at vagenda.substack.com, and you can follow along on social at Dr. Jen Gunter, and she's on Instagram, Twitter, X, Threads, all the things, and we'll link on our show notes.
So, you know, when we talk about a lot of science and health topics that, you know, Jess and myself are debunking, a lot of themes emerge, and one of those themes are that the wellness world, the wellness industry, often praise and exploits women in particular and women's health topics. And part of that is because of systemic sexism and misogyny in medical research. We've talked about that some in our previous episodes on human subjects research. And ultimately, a lot of biological phenomenon that occur in women are understudied and misunderstood, and that makes it easy fodder for the wellness world to exploit, propagate misinformation, and propagate pseudoscience. And one of those phenomena, of course, is related to menopause because it's also something that is stigmatized, right? You know, menstruation, anything related to blood in women's bodies, you know, all of these sorts of things have a stigma socially with regard to them, but none more than menopause because it's kind of perceived as this women are dried up. And they're, you know, no useless, you know, to society. And so, Jen, as you call it the menaverse, the menopause universe. And it's very complicated and it's nuanced. And menopause itself is very complicated and nuanced. And ultimately, that means that it can be filled with bad actors. So, you know, let's kind of start with the fundamentals. Jen, can you describe to our listeners what menopause is and when and how it can present?
Sure. So menopause is the end of ovarian function, ovulatory ovarian function. And so it means that you have no more eggs capable of ovulating and producing the higher levels of estrogen that are needed to basically prep your body for a pregnancy each month, right? So that's what it is. And the average age is 51. The typical range, so where we would, if it happens in this range, we consider it normal between the ages of 45 and 55. And so before 45, we consider that premature menopause if it's between 40 and 44. And if you're under 40, we don't really call it a sort of premature or super premature menopause. We call it primary ovarian insufficiency. And it's really a whole different thing because it can be caused by a lot of different things. And so it's always best to really not have that sort of discussion under the broader menopause topic because there's a lot of different nuances that can go there. And we diagnose menopause or say that it's happened when it's been a year since your last period. And that's really what it is. And I know that there's a lot of doom and gloom that's kind of associated with it. And that's mostly because of the fact that women age out of society, right? And men don't. And so I think it's really important that whenever you hear information about menopause, to always think, you know, how is that tying into that narrative? Is that message supporting the narrative that you're sort of useless without estrogen, that you're, you know, you're a broken body, all that kind of thing, versus what's actually science-based?
So in a nutshell, Jen, you know, you have all of these different reproductive hormones that are produced and secreted by different organs and glands in our body, and that helps regulate that menstrual cycle. And women, unlike men, essentially have a finite number of eggs in our ovaries that could be released and transported through our reproductive system to theoretically get fertilized and you know, turn into a fetus. So ultimately, when menopause is occurring, the fundamentals changes are that hormones and the egg supply are depleted. And so those processes are no longer going to occur. But it doesn't mean that other functions, other physiological functions in our body are also not occurring, right? Is that kind of sufficient to say?
Well, there's a cascade of events that can happen. So, you know, you eventually over time have a lowering of estrogen, although it's really fascinating. There's different trajectories. And so for some people, there's a more rapid drop, and other people, it's kind of a more of a tapering out. You also have an elevation of a hormone called follicle stimulating hormone. And we think that actually some of the changes could be related to high levels of FSH. And so, you know, we're really, I think, just sort of starting to understand how all of these things have this sort of the cumulative biological effects. In the same way with puberty, right? So I always tell people menopause is puberty in reverse. You know, there's a complicated sort of hormone symphony that starts to play and gets together and then creates puberty. And that's kind of the reverse for menopause.
I love that phrasing. And I think it's really important that people understand that hormones affect broadly a lot of things in our body, not just the reproductive organs, right? Because hormones enter our bloodstream and there are these, you know, long-range signaling molecules, and, you know, it participates with our neurological functions and our cardiovascular functions and our immune system. We've talked a lot, and I know you have as well, that, you know, the endometrium is part of our immune system. And so there's a lot of things that can co-occur with the onset of menopause. So, you know, aside from kind of the cessation of the menstrual period, what are other things that the average person should know about menopause?
First of all, as I tell people, it's a normal event. And so, you know, it's not, that doesn't mean it's necessarily pleasant, right? Puberty wasn't pleasant for lots of people, and that's a normal event. And pregnancy is not pleasant for a lot of people, and that's a normal event. But, you know, sort of to kind of normalize it in that way, because I want to push back against that sort of like broken narrative. So, you know, some of the symptoms, the symptom that we associate most commonly with menopause is hot flashes. Or hot flushes, depending on, you know, the country that you're from. And, you know, that's this sort of, you know, feeling of heat that starts in the middle of your body and sort of comes and rises up. And in fact, you know, 300-400 years ago, women used to call it hot blooms, which is actually really much more what it feels like. But, you know, the patriarchy decided to call it a hot flush. So there you go. You know, another common symptom is brain fog, which can be experienced by, you know, about 50% or so of women. Some people can have depression in the menopause transition. Some people can have joint pain. Weight gain around the middle is a common thing that happens as well. And it's completely biologically, like, we don't really know why that happens. You know, vaginal dryness, over time, there can be increased risk of urinary tract infections. And so, you know, those would be some of the more common things, but there's, you know, a lot of different symptoms that can occur. Just like with any, you know, sort of medical phenomenon, there can be sort of a range. But I would say those are like the ones that are most common.
Jen, what is perimenopause? Because that's a term that I'm seeing in articles targeting women constantly now.
Yeah. So perimenopause, We don't really use that term anymore in medicine. We use menopause transition. And so perimenopause is the time leading up to menopause and the year after. And so we usually use the menopause transition to talk about it. And it's the changes in hormones that lead up to menopause. And the average length of time can be sort of from 4 to 10 years. And again, thinking like puberty, right? Some people have a shorter puberty. They, you know, they're, you know, nothing happens. And then boom, they have their breasts come, their growth spurt, they have their period, and it's all within a short period of time. And other people have a really kind of longer drawn out puberty, right? So it's that same thing. And, you know, we don't really, there's this big push to sort of, I'm seeing a lot of 30-year-olds coming in thinking that they're having symptoms of the menopause transition. And it's unlikely if you're in your 30s. I'm not saying it's impossible, but that would be very early. And typically, the type of symptoms that are significant and impact your quality of life don't really start until you start getting menstrual irregularities. So that's kind of a good sort of, you know, way to sort of see if your period is still coming, you know, sort of every, you know, on a regular basis, you know, with a 7-day swing in either direction, which is normal, right? So you can have a period 1 month that's 24 days and the next month that's 30, and that's totally normal. When you start getting swings that are outside of 7 days, that's kind of our signal that the menopause transition has started. Now, it's also important that, you know, people have a wide range of symptoms with all different medical phenomenon, you know, so, you know, there certainly is a possibility that people could have genetic variations that, you know, someone might have more symptoms early. But in general, looking at the large studies, the, you know, that sort of track women over sort of the menstrual experience, usually around, you know, we mark the menopause transition with the first onset of irregular menses.
So before we get in kind of to the diagnosis and treatment and all the wellness misinformation, you know, a question that often crops up, and I'm sure you've encountered this, you know, at length is, you know, what about women who are taking oral contraception or hormonal contraception where they may not be having a period at all, or that period interval is essentially being regulated by hormones that they're taking, you know, exogenously? How would they then go about noticing that they're in this kind of menopause transition?
Well, so for the most part, it won't actually really matter. So there's nothing sort of medically to do differently during the menopause transition if you're not having symptoms, right? So if you feel fine, that's great. And if you're on a hormonal contraception, so for example, if you're taking estrogen-containing birth control pills, the estrogen in the pill will almost certainly, for most people, prevent hot flashes, right? So the ethinyl estradiol that's in the pill, we use, you know, there actually is a hormone therapy, a menopausal hormone therapy that has ethinyl estradiol. It's a very potent estrogen. Now, it's possible it might not be the right estrogen for everybody. And if someone starts to develop hot flashes on the pill and they're 47 or 48, then, you know, we might want to talk about that. But it doesn't actually matter because we treat menopause symptomatically, right? So if you're having symptoms and you're on the pill, then we need to investigate it to see if it's menopause or if it's something else. If, for example, you have an implant like the Nexplanon, that doesn't affect, you know, you still have some egg development each month. It develops a little bit and then goes away, develops a little bit and goes away. And there'll be some estrogen production from that. And so people might start to notice hot flashes and all those same symptoms. And so the only one that, you know, we probably won't pick up symptoms are would be Depo-Provera, which really profoundly suppresses ovulation. And so people get a little less, they get less estrogen production. But with, for example, the Mirena IUD, you know, the great thing about that is you're not going to get the menstrual chaos that can happen because people can have very irregular periods. Oh, I forgot to mention that is like one of the, well, we talked a little bit about it, but irregular periods is sort of the big issue and heavy periods as well. So if you have a Mirena IUD, you're almost certainly not going to get the menstrual chaos, but you still ovulate with the Mirena IUD. So you'll still get those other symptoms. So you'll know. So it doesn't really matter. It really matters more like you're having symptoms and let's like work back from there.
that's super helpful, you know, because I think they're, you know, and of course this is exploited by social media, but there's a lot of misinformation. And, you know, you noted that you have a lot of younger kind of 30-year-old women, women in their early 30s kind of coming in and thinking that they were in that transition. And I wonder if it's a symptom of some of the social media, you know, the, well, you need to balance your hormones, you need to support your endocrine, you need to have this. And a lot of those symptoms you describe, right? The fatigue and the brain fog and the depression, that can be caused by countless things. I mean, you know, in the Lyme disease world, which was kind of my original, you know, academic life, I mean, those are often attributed to the, you know, unrecognized medical condition of chronic Lyme disease as well. And, you know, the unrecognized adrenal fatigue condition as well. And so I feel like some of that, you know, increased attention can be good because it's now leading to conversations about the fact that menopause is normal. You're not unhealthy. You know, yes, it can impact these things. It can impact your libido. You can still get pregnant, like all these other things, but it's a double-edged sword too, right? Because then it propagates some of this misinformation.
I agree. I mean, people come in with absolutely, I mean, not everybody. Some people come in with good information because they've maybe read my book on menopause, or you know, they're following people that follow evidence-based medicine. But I would say the amount of hormone disinformation in the last 10 years has changed catastrophically. So I've been in medicine for 30 years, and the last 10 years versus the first 20 I've been in medicine, it is astounding. And I can only relate that to the propagation of the disinformation on social media. I mean, Christiane Northrup was spouting her hormone BS in the 1990s, but it really wasn't until, you know, she got a leg up from Oprah. And it wasn't until then, you know, social, you know, during the pandemic, she was one of the, you know, whatever, the dirty dozen.
Disinformation dozen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing with social media is, you know, it's not just the bad content, but it's the fact that you see it over and over and over again, right? Propaganda works. And the more you repeat it. And so people come in with these just absolutely evidence-baseless ideas about their hormones. And I feel so badly for them because they've been lied to. But undoing that in even a 45-minute visit is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, so a great example is I'll see people come in and they're quoting this guy, Dr. John Lee, about progesterone. He was a family doctor in the 1980s who didn't do any research, who had this idea that you should give progesterone through the skin. Now, the molecule can't go through the skin. It can't. Nobody, pharmaceutical companies have not come up with a way to make the molecule go through the skin. Going through the vagina is different because that's mucosa. But people come in and they completely believe this. And there's all these, you know, hormone therapy courses and coaches and all this kind of stuff. And if you hear it 50 times, I mean, we know it takes 5 repetitions to make somebody actually start to move the needle on something that's ridiculous. Now, if you come to it and you don't have a medical background, I mean, what they're saying kind of sounds intuitive. And so it's really, it's such a disservice, and people are turning away from, you know, really good evidence-based therapies, and they're getting exposed to potentially harmful treatments because of this disinformation.
And this is really a booming industry. I mean, as you said, everywhere I look, I'm receiving targeted ads for these creams, these hormone creams. I have friends, when I told some of my friends that you were coming on, they're like, ask, I'm rubbing this hormone cream that I got from, you know, Goop or whatever it is on my, you know. So, but I think we should talk about that. So I shared with you right before we hit record that in preparing for this, you know, obviously I'm searching terms like menopause, you know, and now I'm receiving all these targeted ads. And there's one in particular from Goop. I guess there's a product called Madam Ovary. And of course, a bottle costs, you know, $90. And there's a whole article that accompanies it. And it's saying, you know, for some reason, doctors only want you to, you know, take hormone replacement therapy, and they're ignoring all the natural remedies and, you know, alternative therapies. And so they're touting these herbs, like what was the one I mentioned?
Black cohosh.
And Jen, I mean, what you just said is so important. It's not even that these things are, you know, if they did nothing okay, I mean, maybe there's no harm, but then you can make the argument if they're forgoing actual, you know, necessary medical treatment, that's the harm. But there are actual harms to some of these things. So can we start talking about what are legitimate treatments and what are some of these snake oil treatments being recommended for menopause?
Yeah. So, and also I'll add the harm is exposure to disinformation because Goop is a segue to anti-vaccines.
Yes.
It's a segue to QAnon. It's a segue to people who are profiting from telling you there's parasites throughout your body.
Yes.
So I would say that, you know, so that's actually one of the biggest harms of those things is.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, we often see clinicians on social media who are generally evidence-based, but they'll be like, well, you know, my patient, they want to put onions on their feet when they're sick. And, you know, it's fine. I'm trying to support their culture. And it's not fine because you're the patient care provider. You need to be moving them toward evidence-based information. And if you enable that, it makes someone more likely to believe more health misinformation, many of which is far more harmful than what is perceived as being benign, like putting onions on your feet to suck out toxins, which again, does not happen. So, you know, I think that that's the biggest harm of these sorts of things is the propagation and the exploiting of pseudoscience. And ultimately it reduces literacy, health literacy, science literacy.
Yeah. I mean, because all of Goop's, I mean, not all of them, but probably like 95% of Goop experts are people who, you know, it's just, it's fantasy. It's fairy tales, right? So, you know, there's a lot of naturopaths and they're all selling something and they all charge whatever, $700 an hour. And, you know, if this stuff worked, we'd all be doing it. And, you know, it's a conspiracy theory that real medicine isn't offering those therapies. And so I would say the real harm is the introduction to the conspiracy theory thinking that Goop is a soft sell into conspiracy theories. And once you're in, it's difficult to get out. But let's talk about black cohosh. So black cohosh is not recommended by the Menopause Society for hot flashes or for any symptom in menopause. And interestingly, there are definitely reports of liver failure associated with taking black cohosh. Now, nobody actually knows why. And I'll tell you, so black cohosh is an excellent example of why you should not take supplements. So it's an herb that grows or plant that grows in North America. And, you know, people buy into it because of the natural fallacy, right? It's natural. And they also buy into it because of, you know, exotization of other, you know, cultures, because there's a belief that indigenous populations used it, but they didn't use it for menopause, first of all, right? So, you know, so there's that. So a group of researchers actually decided, like, why do some people get liver failure with black cohosh? Like, what's up with that? So they tested a number of brands that were on the shelf. And what they found was a significant percentage, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but something like 25 or 30% in that range contained no black cohosh at all. Okay. It's worse. Some of them contained a different, so they found other plants in there. And so they thought, well, you know, picking plants in a field, maybe you're like picking the wrong ones, right? Maybe this, you get a little bit of contamination from something else. These products were contaminated with a plant that's not native to North America. So it wasn't picked in North America. It came from a different country, right? Or someone's planting a field with different plants. So it's just, so what would you think if every single time you buy a can of chickpeas and a third of the time it contains corn,
right?
That would be on the news. People would be screaming at the supermarket if 30% of the time the product you bought wasn't what it claimed to be.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. it.
U.S. Preventive Task Service just came out with this big review where they found that not even just the black cohosh supplements, but all dietary supplements are the ones that were included. 50% of them were lying about what was inside. Either they were saying something was in it and it wasn't, or they were omitting things that were in them, which could have serious potential interactions and cause serious harms. And people are like, but it's natural, it's supplements. Right. And it's like, that doesn't mean that it's safe.
It's the Wild West.
I could literally scoop dirt from my backyard, put it in a gel cap, and I could sell it as Dr. Jen Gunter's vaginal health supplement. And I could charge, we also know the more you charge for something, the more likely people are to benefit from it. There's a stronger placebo response with expense. I could sell it for $100 a month and probably, you know, make a short, you know, a fortune. And you know what? Taking some dirt from my backyard once a day, the amount that's in a capsule is probably not going to harm you. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it, but you know, kids eat dirt all the time, right? You know, so it's, that's how bad it is. You know, there are companies that you can call up and say, I want to design a supplement. They'll make it for you. You have no idea what their quality control is. And so, you know, the thing is this is supplements are tied to conspiracy theory thinking. So there was a really fascinating research letter in JAMA more than 10 years ago where, you know, this guy surveyed people about conspiracy theory thinking, right? Like, do you believe that AIDS is a construct of big pharma? Do you believe that, you know, vaccines cause autism? Those types of things. Is fluoride damaging your brain? And the more conspiracy theories someone believed, the more likely they were to buy supplements. So supplements are the wheel that drives alternative medicine, and alternative medicine practitioners are invested in conspiracy theories, whether they know that intuitively or not. But it's really fascinating, and it really just shows how just contaminated the whole thing is.
So it's a great segue because, you know, we often see these hormone boosting, hormone healing, endocrine healing supplements. But what would someone actually use to help manage symptoms of menopause? Again, we're not curing menopause. We're not reversing menopause. People should be going through menopause. It's a normal process, but there are legitimate medically indicated options like menopause hormonal therapy. Can you walk us through that? And then maybe we can get into some of the myths that are propagated by the same wellness people who are trying to sell supplements to people.
Yeah. So it depends on your symptoms and your bother factor, right? So if you're not having any symptoms and you're not at high risk for osteoporosis or your symptoms are mild, then you don't need any treatment, right? We don't recommend it as preventative medical care. In fact, the U.S. Preventative Task Force, you know, graded menopausal hormone therapy as a D for preventative care. So first of all, we know that menopausal hormone therapy, meaning estrogen, and if you have a uterus, a progestogen, which could be progesterone or progestin to protect your uterus from cancer. Because if you give someone estrogen without that, you will eventually get cancer of the uterus. So the gold standard for hot flashes is absolutely estrogen. There is nothing that seems to work better. Mind you, we don't have any head-to-head studies with the new drug that's out, fezolinet. And so estrogen is the gold standard for hot flashes and works really very well. A lot of people have severe sleep disturbance from hot flashes at night, and estrogen works very well for that. But I also give people a caveat, there's other reasons for sleep disturbance too. So if a moderate dose of estrogen isn't helping you, then you want to start to look for other things as well, hot flashes. When you start to look at the other symptoms of menopause, then hormone therapy performs less well. So if you look at, for example, joint pain, you know, maybe 15% of people will get a benefit from it. 15 to 20% doesn't mean it's not wrong to try, but you have to, you know, tell people, you know, it's less of a chip shot. There are also some autoimmune conditions and other symptoms that sometimes get triggered by changes in hormones. And so, for example, you know, I've seen several people with burning mouth syndrome that started around the time of menopause. And we have a discussion and we say, look, you know, it might be worthwhile to try hormone therapy for you. If after 3 months there's no improvement in your symptoms, then we can revisit it. And so, you know, it's always thinking about how we're going to revisit things in 3 months. But for example, weight gain around the middle doesn't respond to hormone therapy. Brain fog doesn't respond to hormone therapy. So there's a lot more things going on in the brain than just estrogen. And so, you know, depression in the menopause transition, that actually does respond to estrogen, but depression after menopause does not. And so, you know, there are, you know, different things going on. Some people with menstrual migraines who get a worsening during the menopause transition because hormone fluctuations can really go up and down and up and down, they may benefit from menopausal hormone therapy. And so, you know, it just depends on what the main symptoms are. Vaginal dryness, we recommend vaginal hormones for most people, although there is an oral selective estrogen receptor modulator called ospemifene, which can also be helpful. And so, you know, that's kind of like, you know, MHT in a nutshell. If you're having hormonal chaos induced sort of menstrual problems, right, then hormone therapy is less effective because what you really need to do is shut down ovulation to, you know, to really get that benefit. And some people can have a worsening of their PMS during the menopause transition, and that would respond better to oral contraception with estrogen than to menopausal hormone therapy. It's never wrong if you have symptoms that have started, except like brain fog, which we know doesn't respond, or weight gain. It's never wrong to give it a try to see, you know, has your quality of life improved significantly, and then reassess that. And also for people to understand that for some people, the worst part of their symptoms are in the menopause transition. So 10 years later, they might not need it. The other indication for menopausal hormone therapy is prevention of osteoporosis, but it's not the only drug. There are other drugs like bisphosphonates that can also be used. And so it's important for everybody to sort of assess their risk for osteoporosis. And if you're at higher risk, you can do a FRAX score. You can just Google FRAX score. The thing will come up and you can do that and it'll tell you high risk or not high risk. Or you can do an OST. And, you know, if you Google those and my name and the Vagenda, it'll all come up with links. And then you can, you know, decide if you're at high risk or not. So for example, that's the reason, the primary reason why I'm on menopausal hormone therapy, because my mother died from osteoporosis. So, and she developed it very early and had a very aggressive form. And we don't really know why. I mean, she smoked from the age of 14, so that could be part of it. She grew up during the war in England, so she may have been calcium deficient and had a lower peak bone mass. So, but I don't know. There's no way to know that. And so, you know, for me, and I have low bone density and a high FRAX score. So for me, I also had hot flashes. That was the reason I went on menopausal hormone therapy.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting kind of nuance there, you know, where the symptoms plus the underlying risk factors and family history all have to kind of be factored in when you're choosing, you know, what the best course of treatment is to manage some of those menopausal symptoms. And ultimately, you know, it's actually a good segue because we know that some of these hormonal changes can impact bone density. They can also lead to reduction in overall muscle mass, muscle density. And as a result, we see a lot of that kind of being exploited by the wellness world, right? And so, you know, we see a lot of things about the hormone regulating diets. And this is particularly problematic. I mean, we see the fad diets really in every sphere, right? We've got the autoimmune diet and we've got the this diet and the that and the PCOS diet and the, you know, but the problem is that there are many physicians who espouse this too, right? And so, you know, you walk into a bookstore and you're bombarded with books, you can fix your hormones through diet. You know, Sarah Gottfried, right? She wrote the Hormone Cure and Women, Food, and Hormones and the Hormone Diet, you know, Hormone Reset Diet. And I was just baffled to see that she still has an academic appointment at Jefferson Health here in Philly. It's just, you know, but a person, a regular person goes into the bookstore and they see, you know, Sarah Gottfried, MD, and the Hormone Reset. It's really hard for them to know what's real and what's not. So, you know, what's your general guidance for people who are looking at, you know, we talked about supplements, but what about, you know, these hormone diets or the menopause diet, you know, these sorts of things that are purported to, you know, alleviate or address some of these changes that happen.
So first of all, I'd like to point out that Dr. Sarah Gottfried considers Christiane Northrup her mentor. The anti-Semitic Christiane Northrup, the QAnon loving Christiane Northrup, the anti-vaccine Christiane Northrup, the slut shaming Christiane Northrup. If you have ever read any of Northrup's books, and I did, they are horrific. She consulted an intuitive to decide if she should remove someone's fibroids. She stopped doing abortions, she claims, because women were using it as birth control. It goes on and on and on. Her books are so disgusting. The fact that somebody would consider her as their mentor, to me, disqualifies them from discussing anything medical. That's my opinion. So I just ignore, you know, I tell people, she considers Christiane Northrup her mentor. Christiane Northrup wrote an introduction to one of her books. Did she? So she must believe that a lot of what Northrup says. So that's what I'd like to say about her. If you can't change your hormone levels with the food that you eat, if you could, how could humans have lived in such diverse ecosystems, right? So if you look at the diet of, for example, indigenous people in Greenland versus the diet of people in Japan historically, like thousands of years ago, or the diet of people in Greece, or the diet of people in Somalia, their diets are so different. Right? Humans are incredible omnivores. We had to be to move around to all these places, right? So the idea that there's a single one diet certainly isn't really supported by the fact that humans have lived in places where you can't get the same foods, right? You can't get acai berries in England. Right? You know, you can't get, you know, whatever, you know, there's fish that are only in certain parts of the world there, you know, so, you know, what we know generally, you know, a healthy diet is one that is heavy in plants and grains and, you know, has high quality, low fat protein. Yeah. You know, and that's really it. And it's not sexy and it doesn't sell. So, you know, so I tell people that if there was a diet that was superior besides what I just said, that would be in all the guidelines. So how does a doctor, one single doctor who hasn't published, you know, clinical trials have the answer when that's not what all the people who do the research don't have that answer, right? So, you know, we know what's healthy. You know, we know what is, you know, we know it's having a high fiber diet, having, you know, high quality protein, more plant protein seems to be good. That's also good for the environment too. You know, that, you want to reduce your saturated fat intake. And I mean, it's just not sexy, right? Yeah. So it's sexier to say that you can balance your hormones with food. It's sexier to say that, you know, that you can do all these other things. And so that's why I think it's, you know, always important to look at not just what the message is from the person, but who they're also associated with. Because for me, if somebody likes Christiane Northrup, you know, how could you like her? You know, she, in one of her books, postulated that men who are circumcised are more likely to rape.
Oh my God. Okay. All righty.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. That's
wonderful.
And you know, I mean, aside from all of the heinous, you know, nonsense there, I mean, you know, if there's a clinician, a healthcare provider or a scientist, I mean, we, you know, Jen, you and I were recently kind of connecting on Andrew Huberman, who's doing a similar appeal to authority. You know, if they're espousing or enabling or agreeing with completely statements that are completely antithetical to science, like, you know, he's gym buddies with RFK Jr. And you know, Sarah Godfrey is, you know, mentored by Christiane Northrup, you know, that calls into question, you know, their ability to actually evaluate evidence, right? Aside from, you know, whether or not they've published peer reviewed data or whether or not they're solely, you know, banking on publishing books and, you know, all of that. So I think, you know, that's a huge red flag for people. I also often say, you know, if there's a diet that's named after somebody, it's probably not legitimate.
Right.
Because again, you know, diversity is key, right? And that's going to mean something different to different people. And I think the other thing that people forget is that, like, your body is pretty incredible at regulating itself. And while things change over your life, right? Puberty, menopause, pregnancy, et cetera, like hormones change. it's all really regulated by your organs, your glands, you know, all of your physiology. So, you know, the fact that you could consume something, digest it, and somehow those molecules are going to immediately know where to get to and how to, you know, change things. It's the same concept as like boosting your immune system, you know, in many ways.
Well, you know, so hormones are complex. Diet is complex. Metabolism is complex. All these things are really complex. And so when people try to sort of distill it to like, oh, you can take this supplement or you can follow this one diet, it's very appealing. I absolutely get the appeal. And we've done a bad job at sort of really explaining how the body works to people. I mean, I think people graduate high school knowing more probably about frog, you know, physiology than they do about human physiology. And I mean, I'm not saying like learning about frogs isn't important, but if we're trying to prepare people for life, I think we're doing a really bad job. And medicine's historically done a bad job. And it's really fascinating. You know, medicine has, you know, long ignored nutrition and really didn't sort of become invested in nutrition until, I mean, maybe, you know, I'm going to guess, but, you know, the kind of the 1980s, 1990s, right? And it's really interesting. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, actually, you know, I'm paraphrasing this, but she felt that nutrition was considered unimportant because it was a woman's thing, right? It was woman's work to cook. And that really gets back to the whole sort of ingrained misogyny in medicine. And now, so here we are with the end evolution of that, right? And, you know, I would say that apart from diets that can bump your LDL, which we know it can be concerning with some, for example, ketogenic diets, right? In general, if you're using, you know, eating high quality grains and, well, you know, grains and, you know, legumes and things like that, you're focusing on those in your diet, you know, you're going to have a healthier, you know, outcome. But, you know, it's a real concern because there's people who are LDL deniers, right? Yeah. And there are cardiologists seeing, you know, young men in their 30s with, you know, severe ramifications from this. So, you know, I think it's, you know, it's this whole like, you know, statins are evil. It's like, these are like life-saving drugs. And it gets back to the power of disinformation and the power of propaganda. And how do you counteract someone who's offering a magic wand?
Exactly.
And, you know, and I've become really obsessed with the concept of rhetoric and how we communicate about health. Because, you know, the alternative medicine folks use God terms, right? Everything's natural. It's pure, which all ties into purity culture too, right? Which is disturbing. So they have these God words and they don't have to tell you that, you know, that their whatever hormone blasting diet or whatever is good for you. They call it pure and natural and you fill the gaps in. Versus in medicine, we're talking, we have to use devil terms. Like we have to say, oh, your LDL is high. We have to say like scary stuff. And, you know, people fill in the blanks and they assign sort of badness to that. And so it's really, you know, this use of rhetoric is really, it's very effective. And once you start seeing it, you can't, you know, I always tell people, look for the purity culture words and see how much it aligns with alternative medicine.
So speaking of some of these alternative therapies that are being touted to, you know, to help with symptoms of menopause, what we see in so much of the articles that are targeting women are that, you know, HRT is causing cancer or heart disease and it's dangerous and we need to seek out natural alternatives. And Andrea, you made a great point. Hello, hormones are natural, right? So that's a ridiculous point. But what would you say, Jen, to people who are concerned that, you know, that this is causing cancer and these and that we have to seek out alternatives?
So I would say to people to absolutely abandon the term natural. It's actually not natural to take hormones in menopause. It's natural to not have estrogen, right? You can abuse the word natural however you decide. And so that's really a red flag for me. So, you know, we know that hormone therapy, menopausal hormone therapy is incredibly safe for the majority of people. If you're at very high risk for heart disease, then that's not what we recommend. If you're at very high risk for blood clots, you know, very high risk, then maybe that might not be the therapy for you. And if you are more than 10 years past your last period or over the age of 60, there's a concern that there could be an increased risk of dementia and possibly heart disease associated with hormones. But for the average healthy person, hormone therapy is very safe. There is you know, a small elevated risk of breast cancer that, you know, we believe is associated with menopausal hormone therapy. I know there are some people who like to say that there's no risk, but we also have a lot of epidemiological data that links breast cancer risk overall with higher levels of estrogen, sort of naturally, you know, when I say naturally, meaning without taking therapies. And so, you know, and there are ways that estrogen can absolutely be carcinogenic when you look at it in the lab. But what matters is what happens in the real world when people take it. And in general, the risk when you're taking, you know, estrogen with a progestin is, you know, about the same as a glass of wine a day. Okay. And so that's pretty low risk. And for some people, for the people who don't need to take a progestin, that risk may be lower. And so that may be closer to zero. So the risk is in the very rare range. So I would tell people to be less concerned about that and to look at their quality of life overall. Now, some people who score very high on breast cancer risk with a Gale model, they may not be appropriate for hormone therapy because some of those people actually we recommend going on therapies to reduce the risk of breast cancer. So, you know, obviously there's nuance there. But so for someone not at super high risk for breast cancer, super high risk for heart disease, super high risk for blood clots, it's an incredibly safe therapy. And, you know, it's one of these things that, you know, people twist and demonize to kind of suit their purposes. But it's also important, like any therapy, to take it for what it can help. So Tylenol, you know, it's a pretty safe drug if you take it at the right doses, right? But you wouldn't want to take Tylenol if you didn't have pain, right? So taking Tylenol, you know, to feel more awake in the morning. Well, Tylenol has an incredibly low risk at the right doses, right? But you wouldn't want to assume any risk for something that could not give you benefit, right? So for example, if your only symptom in menopause was brain fog, there wouldn't be a reason to take hormones unless we thought your brain fog was related to not sleeping at night, right? And so that's why it's important to have this sort of detailed history.
And of course, you know, you emphasize, you know, something that people are really bad at perceiving, but literally everything we do has risk. You know, driving a car, getting in your car, getting behind the wheel every single morning has more risk than, you know, most of these medical interventions that we ever discuss. But that ability to perceive risk, or, you know, how one weights those risks, it can be very different, right? You know, so clearly there are benefits to different types of hormone treatments, whether that is hormone therapy or whether that is oral contraception. But then that opens the door for these bioidentical hormones and things like pellet therapy. And maybe we can kind of, you know, near the end of our discussion with this sort of, you know, discussion, because you wrote a really great piece on your Substack about Suzanne Summers and her, you know, opting for these breast cancer treatments that were against medical advice. She had a estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, and she really kind of legitimized these unproven and potentially dangerous treatments. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, first, why bioidentical and pellet therapy is not recommended, and also, you know, why this you know, platforming of unqualified people as experts can be very problematic in this world.
Yeah. So I always like to start with one of Suzanne Summers' experts, who actually wrote the foreword for one of her books, was Dr. Prudence Hall, who was on probation for 4 years with the Medical Board of California for egregious prescribing of hormones when he gave somebody cancer. And really, it's pretty, you know, astounding what she did. She's off probation now, and in fact, was recommended by Goop recently as an expert. Yeah. So there you go. Suzanne Summers promoted absolute evidence-baseless therapy. You know, she developed endometrial cancer or precancer, I believe, while she was on these hormones. That was like never discussed. She had a recurrence of her breast cancer, never discussed. And so, you know, the term bioidentical is meaningless. And I think that's really difficult for people to understand. It simply means a molecule that is similar to what the body makes, but that doesn't mean it's safe. I could take an extract of estrogen from ovaries. I could take a bunch of ovaries, human ovaries, and grind them up and make sure it's safe and doesn't have like diseases.
Sterilize it.
Right, Sarah. And I could give you injections of that estrogen and give you cancer of the uterus. So it's such a meaningless term, and it doesn't imply safety. It just implies a chemical similarity. And the big joke is, no hormone is actually truly bioidentical to what the ovary makes, because your body makes estrogen from cholesterol, and you put your cholesterol together from all different kinds of sources. And, you know, so the carbon isotopes that you use to make cholesterol are all different. But yeah. In the lab, when we make estrogen, we make it from a substance found generally in soybeans now. It used to be yams, but now it's soybeans. So it comes from a single plant source. So the sort of the analogy is, if you get any kind of pharmaceutical hormone, be it compounded or from big pharma, it's like having a bag of Halloween candies with all the same candy. And the estrogen made by your ovaries is like having a bag of Halloween candy that has all the different candies in it. Now, your body just cares about the bag. It doesn't care what's inside. So they're not truly bioidentical. And so it's a meaningless term. It doesn't imply safety. And people also say it's like plant-based. But, you know, if you look at the chemical steps and the chemicals that you're exposing those soybeans to chemically break the bonds and take something that's not a hormone and force it to become estradiol or progesterone or testosterone. If I listed those chemicals, people would be horrified. But that's just chemistry, and you don't need to worry about it.
It's just chemistry. Everything is chemistry.
Because those chemicals are, you know, they levigate out. They get removed. So, you know, bioidentical shouldn't be a reason to take something. And, you know, Suzanne Summers, you know, did a huge disservice. She really, I think, propelled that industry. And I would also blame Oprah, because the day that Suzanne Summers was on Oprah, and Christiane Northrup was also one of the guests, the next day, the top Google search of all time for bioidentical hormones was the next day after that, which shows the power. And so it's just so hard to undo that, because bioidentical is a God term. It sounds like it's a good thing for you. So yeah. What you want is a pharmaceutical estrogen that's been studied and is safe. And the big joke also is the compounding pharmacies are buying their raw estradiol from the exact same plant that the pharmaceutical companies are. They're just packaging it in a way that's less safe.
And insurance doesn't usually cover it.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, if you want to use the term bioidentical, and I hate using it, but sometimes you have to get through to people, you can get pharmaceutical bioidentical estrogen. The estradiol patch would count as that. The pharmaceutical creams, the pharmaceutical rings, the pharmaceutical pills, all of those things would classify as bioidentical.
So Jen, I know we only have about another minute or two here. Just the thing we get a lot of questions about are these over-the-counter menopause tests that are hitting the market. I think Clear Blue now has one, Menopause Journey. Can you comment on that, and maybe any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Sure. So those tests are useless. Don't waste your time. They're absolutely useless. We don't diagnose menopause with blood tests for if you're over the age of 45. If you're 44 or under and you have missed a period for 3 months, you need to see your doctor and you need to have blood tests. Okay. We don't use urine tests. We don't use saliva tests. We use blood tests. And we only recommend those tests if people are under the age of 44. If you are 47 and you have missed 4 periods in a row, it's not a surprise. Just like if you are 12 and you're getting breast buds, it's not a surprise. If that thing is happening at the wrong time, so for example, you're 37 or you're getting breast buds when you're 4, then yes, you need an investigation. But if the event is happening at the time it's supposed to happen and it's a normal event for that time, it doesn't need to be investigated. So there's that. I would say sort of some final thoughts are, be very wary of who's giving you information online. You know, there are chiropractors talking a lot about menopause. They're not medical experts, right? So there's that. And I think one thing we had talked about a bit about on Instagram was metabolism and menopause. And everybody hates to hear this, but your metabolism doesn't change significantly in menopause. There was a pivotal paper that came out in 2021, which actually showed that metabolism has a dramatic change really at 4 phases in your life. And menopause isn't one of them. It's actually over the age of 60. And that kind of makes sense, because evolutionarily, if menopause was harmful, you know, we would all have died out. So there's that. But, you know, it's really important. There is loss of muscle mass with menopause, and it's important to work on that for a lot of different reasons, because it helps reduce falls. It helps build bones. It's good for your heart. It's good for your brain. It's good for your mood. It's good for everything. And so resistance training is super important. And so, you know, you want to speak about that, and, you know, you want to really focus on that. But the idea that there's a dramatic swing in metabolism with menopause is simply not true. And we also don't understand why people gain weight around the middle. It's really kind of a mystery. It's been, you know, it's an active area of study, because we do know that weight around the middle is more likely to be associated with cardiovascular disease, right? And it's an important thing, but we just don't kind of really understand that. So if we don't understand that, there isn't a diet that's going to fix it. And I know there's people out there promoting menopause specific diets that are going to target your middle, but there's no data to support that. Calorie restriction works, whether you do it by counting calories or intermittent fasting or counting macros or whatever way you come to it, or taking Ozempic, whatever way you come to calorie restriction is what loses weight. And studies tell us that you will lose the visceral fat, that fat around your organs, at the same rate with, you know, whatever method that you choose. So there's no kind of metabolism revving, you know, blasting belly fat.
Oh, so the Dr. Oz raspberry ketone fat belly blaster, that's also not a thing.
Yeah. And I would also tell people that if someone is selling you a product, a supplement, a diet, they're actually selling you that, then they're a pharmaceutical company. They're just an unregulated pharmaceutical company.
Exactly.
Would you get advice about your antidepressant from the pharmacy, about antidepressants and depression from a pharmaceutical company that made an antidepressant? No, you would not. You would say, that's ridiculous. You need to treat every single physician, nutritionist, anyone selling those products or recommending products, and there's an ad, so they're getting money from it. You need to treat them as you would a pharmaceutical industry. And I just recommend blocking those people, because you want people that are unbiased. You want people that, you know, when I'm in the office, I'm actually on salary. I get paid the same, right? Whatever I tell you. You know, I don't take any, you know, any ads from anything that's medically adjacent in any way. I mean, Chanel, if you want to call me up, sure. Tiffany's love to, but they have to be like absolutely, absolutely not related to science, yeah, in any way, because, you know, studies tell us that even a drug lunch has an impact on what doctors prescribe. A single lunch. So if a single lunch impacts you, think about somebody who's got their own branded supplement, like all these naturopaths, right? Or right. There's doctors that sell supplements. And, right, you know, so, you know, those people, think about them like a pharmaceutical company.
Yeah. It's a great, great point to leave off with. Thank you, Dr. Jen Gunter, so much for joining us. This was a super important topic. We could chat all day about all things related to reproductive health, but we truly appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise with our listeners. And of course, you can find her at Dr. Jen Gunter on all the social platforms and at vagenda.substack.com. And make sure to pick up her new book, Blood. Thank you for tuning in today. If you want to support our efforts and help us grow the reach and impact of unbiased science, you can send us a donation, or you can sign up for our newsletter subscription on Substack. It's theunbiasedscipod.substack.com. And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel for video and all of our social channels. Our handle is at unbiasedscipod. Catch you next time on the pod, your trusted source for no nonsense, just science. Yeah, oh, I am a scientist.